The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Two people are shot multiple times in their bed. Their teenage daughter calls 911. Her younger sister finds the bodies. And the state says the evidence is overwhelming, but almost none of it is public yet. This is a case about what we're told and what we're shown, and what happens when a child is charged as an adult before the story is finished being told. I'm Mel Barrett. Welcome to the In-Between Podcast.
When James and Kristen Brock were shot and killed in their bed in the middle of the night last February, everybody in their rural Georgia community was shocked.
She messaged me back on June 3rd and just said, search up Brock case. So I said, Brock Turner? Brock who? She said, Kristen and James Brock. They're my parents. And out of nowhere, a random Thursday night in February, someone came in my house with me and my five-year-old sister, and my parents left them for me and my little sister to wake up to.
I just wanted to say goodbye to my mama and James since we never got the chance to. I was so used to you guys always being here to compete that I never once thought to imagine y'all not being here.
Mountains of evidence has gotten us through here today. Lots of processing, lots of working with our law enforcement partners to get us to where we are today, but honed in on her as a suspect.
Today's case is one a lot of you have asked me about, the case of Sarah Grace Patrick, a Georgia teenager accused of murdering her mother and stepfather in their home. This is a case with big allegations, heavy emotions, and a whole lot of confidence coming from law enforcement and some expert talking heads, without a lot of evidence the public is allowed to see. So today we're going to slow this down. We're going to separate fact from narrative. And we're going to sit in the uncomfortable space where certainty is being demanded before transparency has been earned. I like to call this that in-between space. Before we begin, please understand this. Sarah Grace Patrick has been charged, not convicted. She is legally presumed innocent. This episode does not speculate about her guilt. It examines what is known, what is claimed, and what remains unanswered before trial. Some details involve violence against family members and the death of adults by firearm, so listener discretion is advised. And finally, because this case is unfolding online in real time, I want to be very clear about this. We are not here to amplify rumor, TikTok speculation, or internet theater. We are here to talk about evidence, process, and power. Once we move past the headlines, the facts of this case are actually pretty sparse. Kristen Brock and her husband, James Brock, were found dead in their home in Carroll County, Georgia. Both have been shot multiple times while they were in bed. That detail matters because it immediately frames the nature of the violence. This was not a fight that escalated. It was not a confrontation that spiraled. According to what has been publicly reported, they were shot while they were asleep. There has been no public reporting of forced entry into the home, no broken doors, no shattered windows, no indication, at least that we've been told, that someone broke in from the outside. Whether that absence is meaningful or simply reflects what law enforcement has chosen not to release is something we'll come back to, but for now, it's part of the official narrative. There are also rumors abound. Sarah Grace Patrick's parents may have been held up at gunpoint a week prior to their killing. They may have had drug associates living in a shed on the property. None of this I've been able to substantiate, but the rumors are out there nevertheless. The bodies were discovered not by police, but by a younger child who was also in the home, a sister, reported to be 5 or 6 years old. That detail is often mentioned briefly, but it carries real weight. A young child discovering something like this affects everything that follows. The timeline, the emotional chaos of the scene, and the reliability of any immediate reconstruction. After the discovery, Sarah Grace Patrick, the teenage daughter of Kristen Brock, called 911. That call exists. It's part of the evidence. We don't yet have the audio publicly, but the fact of the call itself is not in dispute. Another key fact that's been reported is that no firearm was recovered at the scene. That doesn't mean investigators don't believe they know what kind of weapon was used. It doesn't mean a gun doesn't exist. It simply means that, as far as the public record goes, the weapon was not found in the home where the killings occurred. That's what we know. What we don't know is just as important. We don't know the exact time of death for either Kristen or James Brock. We don't know how much time passed between the shootings and the discovery of their bodies. We don't know whether investigators believe the killings happened minutes before the 911 call, hours earlier, or somewhere in between. That window matters enormously when you're trying to assess opportunity, movement, and decision-making. We don't know the details of the weapon. We don't know what type of firearm it was, who owned it, or whether it belonged to someone in the household. We don't know whether investigators believe it was brought into the home or removed afterward. And we don't know whether it has since been recovered elsewhere. We don't have a publicly released sequence of events inside the house. We don't know who was awake, who was asleep, who heard what, or when. We don't know what physical or forensic evidence supports the state's theory of how this unfolded. And we don't know who investigators initially considered as suspects and how quickly those possibilities were narrowed. The last part is often where cases like this turn. Think of Karen Reed. Because investigations are not just about identifying who could have done something. They're about deciding, often very early on, who couldn't. Once someone is excluded, formally or informally, the investigation changes shape. Leads stop being pursued. Evidence starts being interpreted through a narrower lens. And alternative explanations begin to feel less plausible, not because they've been disproven, but because they've been deprioritized. At this stage, we are being told what happened, but we are not being shown how investigators arrived there. And in a case this serious, that distinction matters. Law enforcement has been very clear about one thing in this case. They say the evidence is overwhelming. Officials have repeatedly described, quote-unquote, mountains of physical and digital evidence.
Mountains of evidence has gotten us through here today. Lots of processing, lots of working with our law enforcement partners to get us to where we are today, but to hone in on her as a suspect.
They've emphasized how long the investigation took, how many resources were involved, and how confident they are in the result. They've referenced assistance from state and federal agencies. All of that is meant to communicate certainty. But confidence is not evidence, and repetition is not transparency. What's striking here is not that the investigators believe they have the right suspect. That's true in almost every homicide case. What's striking is how little of the investigative path has been made public. We haven't seen a detailed step-by-step probable cause narrative. We haven't seen forensic findings laid out in a way the public can evaluate. We haven't seen how other possibilities were tested, stressed, and ruled out. Instead, we're being asked to accept the conclusion without being shown the work. That gap is dangerous, not just for public understanding, but for defendants who are supposed to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. Because when evidence isn't visible, narrative rushes in to fill the space, and narrative is rarely neutral.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is where commentary from so-called experts can do real damage. In this case, one of the loudest voices online has been Jennifer Coffendaffer, frequently introduced as a quote-unquote retired FBI agent. Coffendaffer has publicly claimed that because Sarah Grace Patrick turned herself in, that act should be interpreted as a confession, or at least as an indicator of guilt, and that is supposedly based on Coffendaffer's experience.
Look, law enforcement isn't going to just call up and say, hey, listen, if you don't turn yourself in, we're going to come get you. No, that isn't how it works. They would have went and arrested her if they had the information they needed. So I'm believing that the crux of their case lies within the information that she gave them. In other words, did she give them where the gun is, where she bought that gun, how she learned how to shoot that gun? Did she give them information pertaining to all the details, which is what she should have been briefed about? What made her do this? What was her motive? How exactly did she do it? What, you know, pushed her to the edge of doing it? I would expect all those details to be in a confession. And by the fact that she turned herself in, I think we can look for that.
This is simply not true, though. Self-surrender is not a confession. It's not an admission of guilt. It's often a strategic decision made with counsel, sometimes to avoid a more traumatic arrest or a perp walk, sometimes to comply with a warrant, and sometimes because a person is trying to do exactly what the law expects of them. Courts do not treat self-surrender as a confession. Prosecutors do not get to argue that surrender equals guilt, and juries are explicitly instructed not to. Suggesting otherwise, especially to a massive online audience, fundamentally undermines the presumption of innocence. It turns lawful compliance into a moral failing, and it primes the public to see ordinary procedural steps as incriminating behavior. That kind of commentary doesn't educate, it contaminates. And it's especially troubling in a case involving a teenager. The harm doesn't stop there, though. This case has also been surrounded by deeply inappropriate and frankly disgusting commentary about Sarah Grace Patrick's appearance, including coffin dander, fat-shaming a teenage girl who is sitting in jail awaiting trial for the alleged murder of her mother and stepfather.
And we can look at some of this TikTok stuff. I tell you, just compare that picture with this picture. She's going to continue to get fatter and fatter, and I'll tell you why.
Let's be clear about this. That kind of behavior is not analysis. It's not insight. It is not justice-oriented in any way. It's just disgraceful. Mocking or shaming a defendant's body has nothing to do with guilt or innocence. It does nothing to honor victims. It does nothing to advance understanding. All it does is dehumanize a person who has not been convicted of a crime, and it reveals far more about the commentator than about the case. When a legal process is already stacked with power, prosecutors, law enforcement, pretrial detention, public accusation, adding character assassination and cruelty on top of that isn't just unnecessary, it's dangerous. This is why the distinction between investigation and performance matters so much. When law enforcement says it has extensive digital evidence, that phrase can mean almost anything. It can mean location data. It can mean messages. It can mean search history. It can mean social media activity. Some of that can be highly probative. Some of it can be misleading without context. And some of it can look damning while actually being meaningless. I'd ask you to reference the Veronica Rodriguez case, where the district attorney used several years old messages to slut shame Veronica at the trial, and the jury bought it. So social media, again, it can be damning, but not in the way you'd actually think it is. Without knowing what the evidence is, how it was collected, and how it's being interpreted, the public is left with assertion instead of demonstration. An assertion, especially when amplified by talking heads and viral commentary, hardens into belief long before a jury ever hears sworn testimony. Right now, the investigation exists more as a promise than a presentation. The state is asking for trust while withholding detail, and that imbalance between what's being claimed and what's being shown puts enormous pressure on the eventual trial to correct a narrative that may already be calcified. For a defendant who is legally innocent today, that pressure is not abstract. It's the difference between being judged on evidence and being judged on reputation. Think of the pre-trial media circus that was the Pamela Smart trial or the Karen Reed trial. Everyone had already chosen their corners, and they either hated or loved those two women. And that's why this stage of the case deserves scrutiny. Not cheerleading, not mockery, and certainly not masquerading as expertise. Sarah Grace Patrick has been charged as an adult, despite being a teenager at the time of her arrest. She faces multiple serious charges, including murder-related counts and aggravated assault. A grand jury indictment followed, expanding the scope of what the state intends to pursue. Bond was denied early on, with the judge citing concerns about flight risk and witness safety. Defense attorneys later raised issues related to her confinement, including the fact that she has been held in conditions amounting to solitary confinement because of her age and classification. This is one of those moments where the system's mechanics collide with human reality. Pretrial detention is not supposed to be punishment. It's supposed to be a safeguard. But for juveniles charged as adults, especially in high-profile cases, the line between protection and punishment can blur quickly. The message being sent, intentionally or not, is that this is a defendant the court is not willing to risk releasing, and that message lands long before a jury is ever sworn in. So let's take a look at what the state might focus on. The state's case is likely to focus on access and opportunity. Sarah Grace Patrick lived in the home. The victims were asleep. There was no sign of forced entry. From a prosecutorial standpoint, those facts form the backbone of a circumstantial case. Prosecutors will likely emphasize the nature of the killings, multiple shots delivered while the victims were in bed, to argue intent and deliberation. They may point to the absence of the weapon as evidence of concealment or planning. Digital evidence will most certainly play a central role. Prosecutors have telegraphed that repeatedly. That evidence may be used to construct a timeline, to infer state of mind, or to argue consciousness of guilt. The risk, as always, is that digital behavior gets asked to do more work than it reasonably can. The state's narrative will be one of inevitability, that once the evidence is laid out in sequence, no other explanation will make sense. That's a powerful story when it's supported by clear, corroborated facts. It's a much weaker one if it relies on implication and inference to bridge evidentiary gaps. So on the other side of things, what do we think the defense is going to argue? In my opinion, the defense in this case is clearly preparing a very different frame from the one the prosecution is advancing. One of the central pieces of the defense strategy has been the use of a forensic neuropsychological evaluation, and for good reason. Scientific research consistently shows that adolescents do not process stress, consequence, judgment, or decision-making in the same way adults do. Their brains are still developing, their impulse control is not mature, and their emotional regulation systems can be overwhelmed in ways that look irrational to an adult observer. That is not an excuse, and it's not a legal plea in the abstract. It is a scientific reality that courts are increasingly recognizing, and that may affect how jurors interpret certain behaviors. The defense will likely argue that behaviors the state characterizes as suspicious, things like emotional responses, social media posts, or outreach to others in the aftermath of the deaths, could just as easily be evidence of panic, trauma, immaturity, anxiety, grief, or shock. Adolescents respond differently to overwhelming stress than adults do, and behaviors that look calculated can, in fact, be instinctive or desperate. The defense is also expected to emphasize something that the public conversation has, at times, obscured. There is currently no publicly disclosed motive presented by the prosecution. The absence of a clear motive means the state is asking jurors to fill in blanks with assumption rather than proof. A strong case doesn't just point to opportunity. It explains why a person was driven to commit the act they are accused of. As of now, that explanation in the Sarah Grace Patrick case has not been made public. Alongside their scientific argument and the questions of motive, defense attorneys will almost certainly scrutinize the investigation itself, as they should. That doesn't mean they will accuse law enforcement of misconduct. Rather, they will highlight the very real possibility of investigative tunnel vision, where the early focus on one suspect shapes how all evidence is interpreted afterward. Again, think of Karen Reed's case. When alternative theories are not fully aired or explored, and when certain lines of inquiry are dropped prematurely, it can skew the narrative that eventually reaches a jury. It's also worth stressing what the defense does not have to do. In a criminal trial, the defendant does not have to prove what happened. The defense does not carry the burden of reconstructing the events of that night. Instead, the defense's role is to show that the prosecution has not established guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that there are plausible explanations, including ones the prosecution has not ruled out. And that, in many cases like this, is all a strong defense needs to do, because reasonable doubt isn't a middle ground between certainty and uncertainty. It's a firm legal standard that obligates the state to demonstrate its case with clarity, consistency, and evidence concrete enough to outweigh alternative interpretations. This case has unfolded in an online environment that simply did not exist a generation ago, or even 10 years ago. And that matters because the internet doesn't just react to criminal cases anymore. It actively helps shape them. From early on, there has been intense social media commentary surrounding Sarah Grace Patrick, particularly focused on her alleged TikTok use after the killings. Screenshots, secondhand descriptions, and commentary about her tone, her affect, her timing, and her engagement online have been circulated wildly. Some of that material may ultimately be introduced in court. Much of it almost certainly will not. But all of it has already done its work in the court of public opinion. What's happening here is something we see more and more often. Online behavior has been elevated into a kind of character evidence before a jury has ever been selected. TikTok activity becomes shorthand for intent. Posting becomes proof of mindset. Engagement becomes motive, and none of that is nearly as straightforward as it's being presented. The danger is that online narrative collapses nuance almost immediately. Complex human behavior, especially adolescent behavior, gets flattened into screenshots and captions. Context disappears. Developmental differences are ignored. Trauma responses are treated as suspicious. And certainty becomes a performance rather than a conclusion reached through evidence. This is particularly troubling when prosecutors themselves begin to lean into that narrative, when digital behavior is described broadly as quote-unquote disturbing or concerning, without being tied to specific admissible facts.
Some people just belong in jail. Before their trial, before a final disposition, some people are way too dangerous to be walking among us. And sometimes those dangerous monsters don't look like monsters. Like in the case of Sarah Grace Patrick, the 17-year-old Georgia teen who's accused of murdering her parents and then turning to TikTok for sympathy. This little alleged monster is seeking bond ahead of her upcoming trial. The court should deny that request and keep her locked up. For multiple reasons, I say this, my friends. Number one, she's arguably a danger to society. She has a younger sister as well who discovered her parents were murdered. And that poor child doesn't need to be traumatized any further or have her safety put in jeopardy. Number two, she needs to be forced by the court to comply with any recommended mental health treatment.
It primes the public to see social media use itself as incriminating. It suggests that the mere act of posting, scrolling, or engaging online after a traumatic event is evidence of guilt, rather than one of the many imperfect ways people, especially teenagers, cope with shock and loss. Let's be very clear about this. TikTok is not a lie detector. Social media is not a psychological evaluation. And discomfort with how someone behaves online is not proof that they committed a crime. Adolescents in particular process grief, fear, and chaos in ways that often look inappropriate or confusing to adults. They may disassociate. They may seek distraction. They may reach outward instead of inward. They may post when silence is what we expect. None of that is evidence of murder. At best, it is evidence of being young, overwhelmed, and living in a digital world where emotional regulation often happens in public. The real problem is that once a narrative takes hold online, it becomes self-reinforcing. Creators repeat one another. Commentary hardens into consensus, and before long, TikTok behavior is no longer being discussed as a question, but as a conclusion. That echo chamber doesn't stay online. It bleeds into news coverage. It bleeds into prosecutorial framing. And it inevitably bleeds into jury pools. Jurors do not live in a vacuum, neither do prosecutors. And when a case becomes a story online, complete with villains, tone policing, and moral judgments, it becomes much harder to ask 12 people to approach the evidence with fresh eyes. This is why drawing a bright line between what is provable and what is provocative matters so much, especially in a case involving a teenager. Screenshots are not testimony, vibes are not evidence, and behavior that makes us uncomfortable is not the same thing as behavior that meets the legal standard for guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If this case is going to be decided fairly, it cannot be decided on TikTok timelines or internet consensus. It has to be decided in a courtroom, based on admissible evidence, presented under oath, and tested through cross-examination. Anything less than that isn't justice, it's performance.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
As this case moves toward trial, there are a few questions that matter more than all the noise combined. What evidence will the jury actually see, and how will it be contextualized? How much weight will digital behavior carry? And will jurors be given the tools to understand its limits? Has the state built a case that proves beyond a reasonable doubt, or one that asks jurors to resolve uncertainty with intuition? And finally, what does justice look like when the defendant is still a teenager? The evidence is largely circumstantial and the consequences are permanent. This case lives in the space between confidence and proof. And until that space is filled with transparency, it deserves careful, skeptical attention, not certainty. And there's another piece of this case that needs to be said out loud, clearly, and without any kind of drama, because the stakes could not be higher for Sarah Grace Patrick. If she is convicted of the most serious charges she's facing, she could be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole under Georgia law. Sarah Grace Patrick is 17 years old, but she is being tried as an adult. Let that sink in for a moment. Patrick has been charged with multiple homicide-related counts, including malice murder and felony murder, in the deaths of her mother and stepfather. Under Georgia law, those are the most serious criminal charges a person could face, and the penalties attached to them are severe. For those charges, Georgia allows three possible sentencing outcomes: life in prison without parole, life in prison with the possibility of parole after 30 years, or the death penalty. Because Sarah Grace Patrick was a minor at the time of the alleged offense, the death penalty is off the table. That part is settled law, thankfully. But life without parole is not, which means that if she's convicted, the state can legally ask a judge or jury to sentence a 17-year-old child to die in prison. I want to pause on that for a moment because it's easy to let those words slide past us. Life without parole means no second look, no reevaluation, no acknowledgement that people change, no recognition of brain development, trauma, or growth. It is a sentence that assumes at 17 that who you are at the worst moment of your life is who you will be forever. I've talked about this before, at length, in my work on the Pamela Smart case, and I'm going to say it again here because it matters just as much now as it did then. Condemning someone to die in prison for something they did before their brain was fully developed is not justice, it's surrender. Neuroscience is not controversial on this point. The parts of the brain responsible for impulse control, judgment, and long-term decision-making are still developing well into a person's mid-20s. That doesn't mean young people shouldn't be held accountable. It does mean that permanent, irreversible punishment should require extraordinary justification. Life without parole is the harshest sentence our system has left for juveniles. It is worse, in some ways, than the death penalty, because it offers no end, no mercy, no mechanism for redemption. And yet it remains legally permissible in Georgia. Now here's the nuance that matters, and it matters a lot. That sentence does not apply unless and until Sarah Grace Patrick is convicted. It does not apply today. It does not apply based on allegations, headlines, or internet consensus. It only becomes real life if the state proves its case beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest legal standard we have, or if a plea is entered that includes that penalty. Until then, she is legally innocent. But the possibility of that sentence is already shaping this case. It's shaping how bond is considered. It's shaping how the prosecution frames risk. It's shaping how the public reacts, whether they realize it or not. When you charge a teenager in a way that allows life without parole, you are not just prosecuting a crime. You are making a statement about who you believe is capable of change and who you believe is not. That's not just a legal decision. It's a moral one. And before anyone decides how they feel about Sarah Grace Patrick, before they decide what they think she deserves, they should sit with this fact. If the state gets everything it's asking for, a child could spend the rest of her life in prison with no possibility of release. That is the reality hovering over this case. And it's one more reason why certainty should come after proof, not before it. This case sits in an uncomfortable place, and that's exactly where it belongs right now. Two people are dead, a family has been destroyed, and a teenager is sitting in jail charged as an adult awaiting trial. Those facts can all be true at the same time without requiring us to rush to judgment. What's striking about the Sarah Grace Patrick case is not just the seriousness of the allegations, but how quickly certainty has been demanded, long before the evidence has been fully shown. We've heard commentary from quote-unquote expert talking heads. We've watched a narrative take shape online, built out of screenshots, assumptions, and discomfort with how women and teen girls behave in the world. And we've seen how easily all that gets treated as proof. But the criminal justice system is not supposed to run on vibes. It's not supposed to punish people for being strange, awkward, unlikable, or online. And it's not supposed to turn lawful behavior, like turning yourself in or trying to cope publicly with trauma, into evidence of guilt. At the end of the day, this case will rise or fall on what can be proven in a courtroom, not what feels obvious, not what plays well on TikTok, not what makes us uncomfortable. Proof. Period. And proof matters more here because the defendant is young, because the evidence, at least so far, is largely being described rather than demonstrated. And because once a narrative hardens, especially one involving a teenager, it's incredibly difficult to undo. The job of the jury is not to decide whether they would have behaved differently. It's not to judge tone, affect, or online presence. It's to decide whether the state has met its burden beyond a reasonable doubt. And until that happens, Sarah Grace Patrick is legally innocent, full stop. So the only reasonable place to land right now is here, with questions, with skepticism, with a refusal to confuse confidence with proof or cruelty with clarity. So we'll keep watching this case, not because it's sensational, but because it forces us to confront something uncomfortable about how justice works in the digital age, and how easily we forget that behind every case, there are human beings whose lives are being decided in real time. Thanks for listening. Be good people. Don't do murder. The In Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. Special thanks to my mentors, Amber Hunt, Ellen Marsh, and Rebecca Lavoie, for their super smart guidance and support. If you want ad-free exclusive content, bonuses, and lives, head on over to the In Between podcast Patreon and sign up. The intern level starts at just $4, and there's already 75-plus ad-free episodes for you to binge right now. You can watch my new show, Something's Off with Rebecca Lavoie, over on YouTube at Something's Off Pod, or listen on Patreon. Episodes drop weekly on Fridays. Stay tuned after this episode for the trailer of Something's Off. Follow the In Between podcast on Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube at In Between Pod, and on Instagram at the In Between Pod Official. On TikTok, you can follow me at Jack of All Trades DC. Thanks for listening. Be good people. Don't do murder. Hello, lovely listeners. It's Mel Barrett from the In Between podcast. You know how we dig into stories that don't sit right, the cases where justice feels incomplete? Well, I've got something new for you. Rebecca Lavoie from Crime Writers On and I are teaming up for a brand new show called Something's Off. Every week, we'll take on the cases that make you stop and say, wait, what? From current cases like the murder of Sandra Birchmore to the trial of Karen Reed to the Long Island serial killer and all the way back to the Menendez brothers, when the story doesn't add up, that's where we dig in.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
And I'm Mel Barrett, and this is Something's Off.
He still pressed her, and when he did, she was just like, come on. Like, that was her. It was just like, no, that's ridiculous.
It was exactly how one should respond when being challenged with something that either isn't true or is a distortion of the truth.
How much longer can this go on?
He said, how do you know there wasn't something under where his head landed? And she said, because I saw the photos.
She's not even telling the jury that he made a mistake.
So can we talk about this kind of like bombshelly thing that happened today?
Yeah, you want to talk about the x-rays?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a new tell today.
Where
and
he
it's
would
hilarious.
Repeat back the answer that they just said?
So the tell that I saw, he would ask her a yes or no question. Like he wanted a yes and she would go, no. And he would go, oh. he would just go, oh. You know, mathematical equations. How about the fact that he said there were no x-rays?
Correct.
He, too, is a liar.
Correct.
I mean,
either he was lying or Hank Brennan was lying. And Alan Jackson definitely intimated Hank Brennan has been lying to you. He said to her,
do you agree that a brain is very soft, consistent with, for example, tofu?
Oh, gross.
No. And then Bev said, I'll strike that. No comments.
Yeah.
Watch Something's Off with Mel Barrett and Rebecca Lavoie on YouTube and exclusively on Patreon starting mid-October. I'll leave you a link in the show notes.